morning, and thank you for standing by. All lines will be in listen-only until the question-and-answer portion of the call. At that time, to ask a question, to press star, then one. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may now begin.
Good morning, everybody. This is Jack Stein. I am the Director for the Office of Science Policy and Communications here at the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Welcome to this teleconference specifically focused on the Monitoring the Future 2013 findings. Before we begin, I just want to note that supporting documentation for this teleconference, including press releases, visuals, graphs, and an overview of findings, can be found on the NIDA website, which is at drugabuse.gov. Simply click on News and Events tab and then select the block specific to MTF to be guided to the page. That page will have contact information for the press offices for each of today's speakers, and if you wish to set up individual interviews, you can contact the press office to do so. We will be operating as follows. I'll be introducing three key speakers who will be providing some brief introductory remarks, and then we will open up the lines for individual questions. First, will be Dr. Nora Volkoff. She is the director for the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Following her will be Mr. Gil Kerlikowske, who is the director for the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Followed by that will be Dr. Lloyd Johnston from the University of Michigan, who is the principal investigator for the So with that, I would like to turn things over to Dr. Volkoff from the National Institute on Drug Abuse.
Well, good morning. I want to welcome you all, and I thank you for your attention in the survey that we do on an annual basis to get an idea of what are the patterns of drug use among our youth in school systems, and at the same time to get a sense of their perceptions vis-a-vis the risk of the drug and the access to these drugs. This year actually offers some very good surprises in the positive side, and then actually it also alerts us to some areas where we need to keep paying attention. I'm going to start with the positives because I think it's a very good way of starting the morning. We continue to see significant decreases in the patterns of illicit drug use, and this is extraordinarily important because the drugs that are most frequently abused by teenagers or by adults, by that matter, are the legal drugs, alcohol and tobacco. And in the case of tobacco, cigarette smoking, the decreases have been actually quite large, and for more than 50% decreases over a 10-year period. And they continue to go down, and that is across all of the ages. With alcohol, the decreases are also significant over a longer time period. They are slower, but they are actually on the right direction. We're also seeing some very positive indicators vis-a-vis the abuse of opioid analgesics, which are prescription medications that contain opiates, and which we had seen for many years to be very high, in particular the group of drugs under hydrocodone like Vicodin. We have seen numbers around 10.5% for past year use among 12 graders. Well, this year we saw a pretty significant decrease to 5.3% of 12 graders, which is, over a couple of years we have basically been able to bring the prevalence rate of that abuse of that medication for almost half. The other medication that has been followed with opioid analgesics is OxyContin. Again, levels that we have not been able to see go down at 4.5% on 12 graders for past year. This year, we actually have, something like 3.9%, so also significantly lower. Another very exciting finding vis-a-vis the positives was synthetic marijuana, which we, for the first time in Monitoring the Future, recorded. New drug, and so when we saw 11.5% of 12 graders saying that they had abused it in last year, we were, of course, very concerned because it was a very fast uptake of a drug, much more potent than marijuana vis-a-vis its effects on the cannabinoid receptors and therefore associated with more adverse effects. It was at 11.5 last year. This year it's 7.9. So this is, of course, very good news and probably reflecting attention of the media on the adverse consequences that may have changed the attitudes towards it. Now, on the other side, so the negative, the worrisome side relates to the use of marijuana. We continue to see slow increases in the use of marijuana across all of the three ages, 10, 12, and 8th grade. And of the indicators that we have of marijuana, though, the one that has attracted me the most attention, and not because it had increased from last year to now, it's the regular use of marijuana. It's 6.5% among 12th graders and 4.4% among 10th graders. These are very high numbers, considering that these are kids at school. So we are not entering into these numbers those that drop out or that may have missed school, which are much more likely to be the case for marijuana abusers. Reasons of concern: adolescents are very sensitive, are more sensitive to the deleterious effects of drugs of abuse in the brain because the brain is developing. And in particular, the cannabinoid receptors, which are actually the ones that are stimulated by marijuana, are intimately involved in the development and the connectivity of the brain. So interfering with this process is likely or could result in changes on the way that the brain functions. Second, we know that the marijuana, use of marijuana, interferes with learning and memory. These kids at school are going to be unable to properly learn if they are using marijuana regularly, and that will translate into the deterioration of their academic achievement. And finally, we know from epidemiological studies that the earlier you start using a drug, the greater the risk of addiction. And in the case of marijuana, the studies are showing that the earlier you start, not only the higher rates of addiction to marijuana itself, but actually to other drugs of abuse. So marijuana is an area of concern, and there are also concerns vis-a-vis decreases in the perception of risk from this drug. And another area of concern that I do want to put in the table, because it actually has been creeping in the past years, and it has attracted some level of attention, is the abuse of stimulants by teenagers. 12th graders, this increased last year to 8.7%. And these drugs are used not just to get high and have fun, but they are actually used by kids with a perception that they will improve their performance. So they tend to take it just prior to exams. So these are, to me, the most salient numbers that are coming out of the survey. There are other data sets, and you will hear from them. But I think on the one hand, we see the positives on the legal drugs. On the other hand, it does address that we need to pay attention to the significant increases that we are observing in marijuana that we need to address. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Volkov. Our next speaker will be Mr. Kralikowski from the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Director?
Good. Well, thank you, Dr. Stein, very much. And Dr. Volkov, we appreciate the work that you and everyone at NIDA does, and particularly your leadership in protecting America's youth. I want to take a moment to acknowledge Dr. Lloyd Johnston, a distinguished research scientist at the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research and the principal investigator of Monitoring the Future. This is an important study every year. Lloyd, you have been doing this for a long time, and I really want to personally thank you for your decades of work on the survey. Well, I'd like to provide some context about the importance of today's survey results. President Obama has outlined his vision of an America built to last, a nation where an educated, skilled workforce has the knowledge, energy, and expertise to compete in the global marketplace. Yet, for too many Americans, that vision is limited by drug use, which not only limits the potential of the individual, but jeopardizes families, communities, and neighborhoods. Well, moreover, thanks to decades of research and study, much of it through NIDA, we know that substance use, particularly among young people, has serious consequences. Scientific research indicates that young people are more vulnerable to the negative consequences of drug use. Their brains are still developing, and conditions for their success later in life are being cast in these important formative years. While this year's survey contains some good news regarding declines in the use of pain relievers and synthetic drugs, it also contains information that should concern every parent, teacher, and employer across the nation, and it portends more serious challenges in the years to come. Today's results regarding marijuana are disappointing. As Dr. Volkov has pointed out, over the past decade, the perception of risk among high school students of regular marijuana use has dropped dramatically. Making matters worse, more teens are now smoking marijuana than smoke cigarettes. Well, this isn't a recipe for raising a healthy generation of young people who are prepared to meet America's challenges. and yet it should not come as a surprise. Science clearly demonstrates that marijuana is not a benign substance. Among other consequences, it hampers academic performance, it impairs driving, it impacts productivity, and for some to say that it is less dangerous than other substances is a ridiculous statement. Today, for the first time in the history of the survey, there is evidence suggesting that regulation schemes that have been promoted by the marijuana legalization lobby are not succeeding in preventing the diversion of marijuana into the hands of young people, as was promised to the voters. Looking at the last 2 years combined, 34% of marijuana-using high school seniors living in states with medical marijuana laws say that one of the ways they obtain the drug is through someone else's medical marijuana recommendation. The good news is that despite increasing rates of youth drug use, we know we're not powerless against this challenge, and education is our most powerful tool. Well, put simply, prevention saves lives and it cuts costs. Research demonstrates that if we can prevent young people from using drugs and alcohol through their teenage years, the likelihood of them developing substance use disorders drops dramatically. So today, I am continuing to call upon all of us to recommit to bolstering education, prevention, and involved parenting. The young people represented in today's study are making decisions that are going to affect their future and the future health of the next generation of our leaders, innovators, and citizens. At this critical moment in their development, they deserve full support to make healthy decisions, to choose a life that is not hindered by drug use. And for parents looking for resources or tips on how to talk to young people about drug use, we encourage you to visit the partnership at drugfree.org or NIDA's website at www.drugabuse.gov. Well, let me close by saying a word about our path forward. And I've said many times before, law enforcement is always going to play a vital role in keeping communities safe. And at the end of the day, however, we cannot arrest our way out of any drug problem. And the Obama administration has a drug policy reform plan that treats our nation's drug challenge as a public health issue, not just a criminal justice issue. It puts forth a series of alternatives to the war on drugs enforcement-centric approach on one hand and legalization on the other. These alternatives include expanding prevention, early intervention, treatment, smart on crime reforms that are based on evidence and science rather than ideology or dogma. This is what 21st century approach to drug policy looks like as we work to build a nation that is healthier and safer. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Our last speaker is Dr. Lloyd Johnston from the University of Michigan. Dr. Johnston?
Thank you, Jack. Thank you all for tuning in. This is the 39th national survey in the series, began in 1975, and it's a pleasure to announce it with Dr. Volkow and Director Kurlikowski. And thank you, Dr. Kurlikowski, for your kind comments. Just to tell you a few things about how the study's done, this year we had about 42,000 students in 389 secondary schools, both public and private, and they are representative of students in each of the three grades we study, 8, 10, and 12, in the coterminous United States. They fill out self-administered questionnaires in a normal classroom for about one class period, and these surveys are conducted by University of Michigan personnel. So the youngsters know that their answers won't fall into the hands of anybody in their school. The samples, as I mentioned, are representative of students in each grade. One notable fact to me, having studied these behaviors over the years, is the number of drugs that continue to arise on the scene. Our questionnaires have gotten longer, it seems, because there are so many drugs that we ask about. I think we ask about over 50 classes and subclasses of drugs now. And unfortunately, not a great many leave the scene, although some have, like PCP, So there's always a concern about the new threats and the danger that we don't know enough to caution people about those threats. And I think we've seen some of that recently in three of the newer drugs, synthetic marijuana, bath salts, and salvia. Synthetic marijuana, as you've heard, is in sharp decline this year in use, and it's started from a pretty high level, the second most widely used drug among the older teens, after marijuana itself. So there's a lot of reports from the poison control centers about adverse consequences, up to and including suicide. So I think it's important that we've seen a turnaround in that case. The FDA scheduled a number of the ingredients to these drugs, and that undoubtedly helped to create the turnaround. Bath salts showed a very sharp increase this year, maybe the sharpest we've ever seen, in the proportion of youngsters who see it as dangerous. So I think the word has gotten out, largely through the media, that bath salts are not something to fool with. Unfortunately, the rates have remained quite low, at 1% or less in each of these grades, which I think is very good news. You'd like to see it go to zero, of course. But there are still horror stories that come out and are in the press. And finally, salvia was introduced into the study in 2009, and then since then we have seen a continuing decline in all three grades, and it continued again in 2013. This is a drug in the mint family that is often smoked. So those are some good developments about newer drugs. Now, some of the established drugs are also declining. Dr. Volkow mentioned some of these, inhalants, gases or sprays that youngsters inhale or huff, have been going down in all three grades, and the decline continues this year. I think that's good news, especially for younger teens who are the ones most likely to be using inhalant drugs. The class of drugs we call hallucinogens other than LSD, which for the most part is comprised of psilocybin use, or shrooms, also continues to decline in all three grades. And Vicodin, as you heard, went down sharply this year in 12th grade, highly significant 2.2 percentage point drop to 5.3%. So that's good news on a narcotic drug and a legal one with prescription that that begins to address the problem that emerged in the late 90s and early 2000s, and that is the misuse of prescription-type drugs. Needless to say, the declines in cigarette use and alcohol are very important. They're long-term declines that continued this year. We saw about a 1 percentage point drop in the proportion of youngsters in all three grades combined who say that they actively smoke cigarettes. And that's roughly a 1/10 drop in the number of smokers in the age group. So a very important change and significant this year, and it follows a similar change last year. So even though the rates went down more sharply in the late 90s and early 2000s, we're still seeing progress, and I think that's very important. And with alcohol, we've seen both 30-day use, that is any use in the past 30 days, and binge drinking, five or more drinks in a row, dropped to their lowest levels in the history of the study. So we've now seen drops in binge drinking of about 6/10 in 8th grade, 4/10 in 10th grade, and 3/10 in 12th grade. So very important and substantial declines since the peak levels were reached in those behaviors. If you'd like to see more of the detail that we have on tables and figures, and there's a lot, you can look at our press releases. Just go to www.monitoringthefuture.org and right on the home page to the connection to the releases. Thank you.
Dr. Johnson, thank you very much. For anybody who joined the call late, just once again to refer you to the NIDA website at drugabuse.gov for supporting documentation related to monitoring the future. And with that, we have time to open up the lines for questions. Everybody's lines will be muted except for the individual that, in fact, has a question put forth. And we will begin that process right now.
Again, to ask a question, to press star, then one. One moment. Again, to ask a question, to press star, then one. Jonah Engel, your line is open.
Hi, this is Jonah Engel from The Beacon. I have a question for Director Kerlikowski. You note rising rates of marijuana use among youth and decreasing levels of concern about the drug among that population. We've had drug education in schools for at least three decades now. Why do you think that these prevention efforts haven't led to more decrease in marijuana use?
We've actually had really sporadic drug education in schools, and in particular, if we look over these last few years, many, many schools, along with other programs, have been reduced. It's oftentimes a very short or quick part of maybe a healthcare curricula within a school, but we know from prevention research that it has to be consistent, it has to be age-specific, and it has to be over a period of years. And I think you could probably count on both your hands the number of schools that have actually taken on in this country comprehensive, dedicated health-related prevention programs. So I think that's probably one of the reasons. As adults and as the heads of schools and others, we just really haven't done a very good job of putting forward the science and the information that young people need to be able to make a good decision about what they're going to put into their bodies.
Thank you. I believe there's another question.
Susan Heavey, you may ask your question.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Susan Heavey with Reuters News. We've also seen, especially last year with elections in Colorado and Washington, sort of this growing shift to allow more marijuana use. In what way do you see that trend impacting things here?
Well, one of the there's been a series of reports, actually, to try to see if there are differences in the prevalence rate of marijuana use among the states that have legalized marijuana recreationally or whether the states that have legalized it for medical purposes. And indeed, those states have higher prevalence rates than those that have not among teenagers. The issue that is difficult to determine is this causally link. And the reason why one is not so simple to disentangle is that those states voted approval for this marijuana because evidently already the perception of those states was different from those that rejected them. So we don't know what came first, but one of the things that we're doing at NIDA with these changes in policies, we have requested proposals and we're currently already funding researchers to be able to address what are the consequences of these changes in policy vis-a-vis the prevalence rates of marijuana, but we're also interested in knowing vis-a-vis the effects on school performance, vis-a-vis the effects on emergency room admissions, vis-a-vis the effects on car accidents.
Okay. And how long do you think that'll take to figure out?
Well, I think that some indicators come faster than others. In particular, for example, that's why we're very interested in looking at educational achievement, because increased use of regular marijuana should be able to translate pretty rapidly in changes in performance. So being able to track those. Others like addiction, and there's been an increase in the number of individuals being admitted for addiction to marijuana. That takes longer because it requires longer exposure. So depending on the outcome, it may be sooner or later, but we're giving this a priority currently.
Thank you. Another question, please again continue to identify yourself.
Deborah Browser, your line is open.
Yes, thank you so much. Based on the results from this year's survey, do you have any recommendations for clinicians when it comes to some of these increases, should they be maybe doing more screenings, or are there any kind of recommendations that you have?
I think that this is a very, very good question, and indeed, as we are faced with an increase in the use, and we're speaking just about adolescents, but this is likely to translate also in adults, and their healthcare system can play a very important role in prevention and screening for the use of marijuana, asking the question both with respect to abuse because it wants for its rewarding or relaxing properties, but also questioning for the potential whether they are being receiving prescriptions for marijuana for medical purposes is going to be very, very important. And again, it's something that the healthcare system has not been paying too much attention to. And to address questions of, for example, how does marijuana interact or with other medications that may be used? What is the rate of marijuana use, for example, during pregnancy? I mean, some very important questions that are that the clinicians are going to be faced, for which we have very little information because, again, we're facing a new change in policy. But the advice, therefore, for the clinician is to screen for the use of drugs in general, but definitely also for including the use of marijuana, supposedly for medical purposes.
One issue that we are aware of is that in the medical marijuana states, and that's a growing number of states, we looked at the youngsters who used marijuana in the past year in those states and then in the states that don't have medical marijuana. We saw a large difference in the proportion of them who indicate that one of their sources of getting marijuana is other people who have prescriptions. And in fact, 6% of them indicate that they have prescriptions. These are high school seniors, so they're 17, 18, sometimes 19. So it may not be illegal for them to have a prescription at that point. But the general point is that this provides a potential avenue for young people to get marijuana, and I think that's something about which most people are pretty concerned.
Okay, thank you. Another question in the queue?
David Pittman from MedPage Today, your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to follow up about the point that was just made about the medical marijuana states. Is there any... Why do you think this is the case that these prescriptions are falling in the hands of high schoolers or may not be intended for, and what can be done to prevent this? Also, additionally, Dr. Johnson, if you can sort of give more information on, you say that the respondents in the survey were representative of the schools and the grades. Can you be more specific on how you know that is the case?
Well, the schools aren't drawn to be representative of marijuana law states or medical marijuana states. They're drawn to be nationally representative, but a fair number of states do have those laws now. And I'm trying to remember what the numbers of cases are. That case, we're talking about 1,000 students in the non-medical marijuana law states answering the questions, and about 600 in medical marijuana law states. So it gives you some idea of the proportions. And they answer both the question about did they use someone else's marijuana and do they have their own prescription.
But more specifically, I mean, who is it that are is deciding, how is it decided that these are these survey respondents are representative of their respective schools and grades?
Another representative?
No.
they're representative in the sense that I think they're representative of all states. One very large state that represents a lot of kids is California. And so that probably weighs in more heavily than the other states that have done so. But I think there's at least a dozen states now that marijuana use, maybe considerably more than that.
I'm not sure, Samantha, the first question was answered about why exactly this is the case that these medical marijuana prescriptions are falling in the hands of high schoolers and what if anything can be done to prevent this.
I understand that question.
Yeah, no, I think it is. Why are they, how do they end up by having marijuana that is from a prescription that was not intended for them? And that is actually very similar to what we see with the abuse of psychotherapeutics, where we ask, researchers have been asking the question, where do they get their pain medications like Vicodin or OxyContin or the Adderalls and Ritalins that they are abusing? And most of the marijuana, I mean, in this case, and we're speaking of prescriptions, comes from actually it's given to them by friends or relatives, but approximately 30% of it comes from prescription, from drugs that were given through a prescription. So this is actually just the fact that you are having them available because it was delivered to a prescription makes these kids take it out from the bathroom cabinet or from their home, so one could see a similar situation. This, for us, it's new, and I think that the monitoring the future, this is a new question vis-a-vis the prescription. So exactly does it mimic what we've been seeing in psychotherapeutics? We don't know exactly to what extent it mimics, but one can predict that there is a similar phenomena as we have seen for psychotherapeutics.
Let me go ahead. This is Gil Kerlikowski, and also mention the promise in medical marijuana states to the voters was that there would be regulatory schemes to prevent marijuana from falling into the hands of young people. In every state, that promise has clearly been broken. And I'll give you an excellent example of the state of Colorado, which was held up by the journalists of Governing Magazine as the gold standard of regulating medical marijuana. Unfortunately, both an audit by the city of Denver and an audit by the state of California, or the state of Colorado, essentially said that their regulatory scheme, that medical marijuana was unregulated. So I don't think we should be surprised when we see that alcohol gets into the hands of young people, prescription drugs, which are highly regulated and controlled, get into the hands of young people. Why we would have believed that the promise that marijuana would not get into the hands of young people is a bit beyond me.
And also, you know, in bringing up the comment of Director Gil Kerlikowski highlighting how many of these things are actually unpredictable. In the past couple of months, there was a paper published in JAMA that reported a very significant increase in emergency admissions of infants or children that have basically been intoxicated from marijuana, from the use of products that have been sold in Colorado. And this wasn't really in the radar of anyone because nobody has really seen admissions on emergency room secondary to a kid getting poisoned from marijuana. So access to these products, and if someone has a prescription, if parents have a prescription, and they are not careful about it, then this could be one of the consequences. I think that it does highlight the difficulty of having control of these substances towards those that you want to protect, like children and adolescents.
Okay, we have a number of other questions in the queue. We'll take the next one, please.
Evie Blatt from Education Week, your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I'm curious about if you know if there's a correlation between attitudes about the harmfulness of marijuana and the likelihood that a student would use it because of that attitude. I'm also wondering if you could explain sort of in a simple fashion a little more about the effects of marijuana use on a developing brain. At what age is a teen sort of or an adult out of the woods as far as its effect on their brain development, and what part of the brain is affected? What does that part do?
Maybe I can speak to the relationship with attitudes, and Dr. Volkow will speak much more knowledgeably about the brain effects. Yes, we've seen in various historical periods a strong correlation between changes in perceived risk for a drug, including specifically marijuana, and subsequent increases or decreases in use. And we have a couple of papers in the literature on that. We've seen similar effects with cocaine and also documented in the literature and with various other drugs. So it's a fairly strong association that we've seen consistently. And in a sense, perceived risk has become a leading indicator of problems to come. You don't get many leading indicators in the social sciences. They're mostly in the economic sciences. but this is one, and so we take it seriously.
Now, with the brain, cannabinoids, you produce your endogenous cannabinoids, and they interact with a wide variety of receptors. Those that have been the most investigated are the cannabinoid 1 and the cannabinoid 2 receptors. And particularly, the cannabinoid 1 receptor has extremely high concentrations in the brain. Apart from the traditional excitatory and inhibitory neurotransmitters, glutamate and GABA, cannabinoid receptors are the most abundant. So they play a role in multiple processes. And their function actually varies as a function of brain development. During the stages from fetal to adulthood, the brain is changing very abruptly. And it doesn't really stop changing completely. I mean, until we are, even as adults, it continues. But the speed of change, the largest changes are basically terminate around age 21, 22. Now, during that period of time, and here is from childhood into adulthood, the levels of cannabinoid receptors change dramatically. So they are extremely, extremely high during childhood and early adolescence, and then they slowly decline to lower levels until you reach those that are that you achieve in adulthood. And the function of these cannabinoid receptors, along with the endogenous cannabinoids, is to modulate and regulate, among other things, the connectivity in areas of the brain. So the brain is really a set of networks. Neurons communicate with one another, and there's communication short range and long range. And that pattern and density of those communications, those fibers, are in part regulated by cannabinoids. And so one of the questions that researchers, because research has been showing that if you do expose animals or even studies now with imaging technologies in humans, during adolescence, and again, I'm referring adolescence to marijuana, you actually can profoundly affect that connectivity. And the connectivity disruption is not widespread. There are some areas where you see it specifically expressed, and in particular, one of the most affected areas is the connections into the hippocampus, which is the area that is involved with memory, which could, in a way, perhaps account for why the studies that have looked at intelligence quotients in kids that have abused marijuana during adolescence have reported a decline in cognitive abilities, a disruption of the communications of the hippocampus, which is involved on everything related to learning, could be one of the mechanisms. So this is one of the major concerns vis-a-vis the use of marijuana in adolescence, that it will be interfering with the normal orchestration by which the brain develops from its inception into the complexity that it reaches as an adult.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Volkov. Just an FYI for those on the phone, if there's more specific interest in this type of discussion, one-on-one interviews can be arranged via our press office. We have another question, I believe.
Alison Knopf from Alcoholism and Drug Weekly, your line is open.
Taking my call. I think this is probably for Gil. There's been a lot of discussion about medical marijuana, but what about legalization, the perception that marijuana can be a recreational drug like alcohol and tobacco, also banned for kids, but the top drugs kids use. And, you know, as you just mentioned, we know that if perception of risk is down, use is up. So in terms of legalization, the Federal Justice Department let this happen in August. So while this was disturbing to many treatment and prevention people, maybe it was too new to be registered in the survey. Do you have any comment on this at all?
Sure, I'm happy to comment. First of all, I think the memorandum from the Department of Justice is very specific, and I think the very first principle is that they will continue to enforce federal law. But then regarding those two states in particular, Colorado and Washington, they have a series of bars that they will watch very carefully, and we will be assisting the Department of Justice in that data gathering over areas involving youth use, drugged driving, money that may come from the that industry that could be used involving organized crime. So I think that it's an important issue, and one that clearly these two
two states are engaging in a very large social experiment, and as much of the information that we're beginning to see portends that they're going to have a very difficult time.
It seems improbable that we could have as many states having medical marijuana laws and now two states having full legalization, that wouldn't have an impact on how young people see marijuana. So I'd be quite surprised if the perceived risk had been going up or had been flat. And in fact, it's going down rather sharply. And we have to remember that the effects are not only the direct effects in the state in question, but these discussions, as you well know from being in the media, are nationwide. So when two states legalized, that was an issue that was carried throughout the country, and youngsters throughout the country were exposed to the discussion and the issues.
Right.
We have several other questions, and we are getting a little tight on time, so let's move on to the next one, please.
Julian Hatchern from The Hill, your line is open.
Yeah, thank you guys for taking my question. Thank you so much for doing this call. This is definitely a follow-up to these other questions about medical marijuana and legalization. I mean, just continuing that effort, shouldn't it make sense that as regulatory efforts to medicalize marijuana seem to have failed to prevent marijuana from getting to kids, in your opinion, that legalizing will also lead to that? And kind of more broadly, isn't this... is there a kind of a losing battle here as larger public opinion seems to be changing as it relates to marijuana? What can you do to combat that?
Well, this is Gil Kerlikowski. I think that it's important to recognize that for the last several years, the president has requested media campaign money for the science to be put forward, as it has been for many years, about prevention around drug use. Unfortunately, Congress has not funded that in the last 2 years. We have been working with social media. We've been working with the partnership at drugfree.org to have quality prevention messages that have been tested and retested and evaluated. And we even know from several peer-reviewed articles regarding those prevention messages that they can, in fact, have that they can be effective. We know that without funding, of course, it's very difficult then to get that message out. Those that wish to legalize and downplay the concerns regarding marijuana are incredibly well funded, and we saw that both in Colorado and Washington State with the advertisements that were put forward on every media.
Do we have another question?
Fabrin Watts from American Psychiatric Association, you may ask your question.
Hi. Yes. So it was reported that the synthetic marijuana dropped from 11.5% to 7.9%, roughly a 4-point drop within a year. What do you think is the reason for this sharp decline in synthetic marijuana?
Well, I think that it's going to be speculative because it's based on what we think is going on, but not that we have the data. In the healthcare system, for example, the use of synthetic cannabinoids have been associated with actually very adverse consequences. There's been already several reports under a relatively short period of time of individuals smoking this synthetic marijuana ending up with strokes, severe strokes. And this has to do with the fact that cannabinoids can produce vasoconstriction. And this has attracted a lot of attention of the media. And there has been, of course, some fatalities for the display of portraying these negative consequences that also, in, by the way, are discussed in the web, I think has had a way of making youngsters aware that this is a much more risky drug than it's portrayed. In fact, it's sold in the stores as not for human consumption. So it is as potpourri in the sense that it would be a benign compound. So I think that part of the consequences when you have something that's very, very harmful, it actually, the consequences appear so rapidly that then this actually leads to the decline in the use of the drug. And we saw that actually too with ecstasy at one point with all of the adverse effects or with MPTP that resulted in terrible toxicity immediately killed the drug.
I might add that the American Association of Poison Control Centers lists the following as consequences that they see from people who come in and said they've used synthetic marijuana: severe agitation, nausea, vomiting, muscle spasms, seizures, tremors, intense hallucinations, psychotic episodes, and suicidal and other harmful thoughts and or actions. So these are pretty serious consequences. And it's not surprising in a way when you consider, and this is also true for some of the other synthetic drugs, that these are constantly in motion because they're moving around molecules in order to avoid the FDA bans. And nobody's testing these new versions of the drugs. And really, nobody knows what the consequences are, including the people who are making it. So I think it's very important, and I've tried to make this point over the years, that youngsters realize that these are not people whom they want to be trusting. A lot of these drugs are made in China. And even the legal products in China are often harmful. So I think an important message to get out to kids is that these kinds of drugs, whether these or other ones, are particularly dangerous because they're untested, and nobody really knows what their consequences are until they occur.
Thank you. I believe we have time for two additional questions.
Bahar Golapour from Life Science, you may ask your question.
Hi, yes, thank you. So I saw that the report found that 20 to 30% of seniors reported having used marijuana in the past month or so. My question is this occasional use concerning too, and if so, why?
Is this occasional use, you say, of concern?
Yes, as much as it is, as much as the daily use is concerning.
I mean, a priori, I would say that the more frequent that you use a drug, the higher the likelihood that you have adverse consequences. Nonetheless, monthly use, what we say is once a month, of use of marijuana is actually, I would say that it's non-trivial, because if anything, just being the most conservative perspective, marijuana, there's a load of cannabinoid receptors in the hippocampus. And when someone is intoxicated, and this is no matter what age, you really cannot memorize or learn. And as a result of that, if you are a student in high school, you're going to be interfering with your performance, and that will then affect your grades. So you start almost like a domino cumulative effect. There are also other actions of marijuana that basically may have consequences too that are negative. When you are not intoxicated, so when someone is intoxicated, there is this sense of relaxation. But as the drug leaves your body, the anxiety goes up, and so you see an increased anxiety during periods where the individual is not taking marijuana that are also going to be detrimental. And it's also associated with dysphoria, again, when the drug leaves the body. So you have these adverse consequences. And the one that Director Karolikowski mentioned, that we cannot underestimate, that when you are taking once a month marijuana, either you or your friend, you may be in a car that someone is intoxicated, or you are intoxicated and driving, and that in turn is going to increase the likelihood of accidents. So I would say that being the most conservative, even monthly, the not so frequent as regular, is an area of concern. And that is that's why you want to actually, basically in a prevention, you want to prevent kids from abusing these drugs.
Okay, thank you.
And we have time for one last question.
Donna Engel from Beacon, your line is open.
Oh, that's okay. My question was answered.
Okay, well, thank you. In that respect, we will wrap up today's conference. Again, drugabuse.gov is the NIDA website. On the Monitoring the Future page that you'll see on the homepage, you can have contact information for all the press offices for each of today's speakers if you wish to set up individual interviews. Thank you very much for your time today, and please join me in thanking our three presenters and speakers. So thank you very much.
This concludes your conference call. You may now disconnect. Thank you.